Binge Mode is brought to you by DirecTV Now. Live stream your favorite channels on virtually any device. Plus, you can subscribe to HBO and start watching Game of Thrones today. Hodor.
Hodor.
Buddy, I know you're looking for something to do down there beneath the cave, but I want to make sure you know.
Hodor.
Binge Mode contains adult content. If you're okay with what you see on Game of Thrones, you'll be okay with Binge Mode.
Hodor?
And now, Binge Mode.
Promise me, Ned.
Hello!
Woo!
And welcome to Binge Mode!
Da da da!
I'm Mallory Rubin, deputy editor of TheRinger.com. Joining me today, now that he's finished publicly shaming numerous seasoned battle commanders and northern lords for failing to honor their pledges and step up and do what's right, it's Ringer staff writer and your maester, Jason Concepcion.
Hello!
Jason?
Yes?
I don't want to die.
You're not going to die. Is there a maester here?
Promise me. Promise me. We said that we were going to rewatch all 60 episodes of Game of Thrones.
I remember saying that.
We said we were going to deep dive one episode at a time.
Yes.
And today, we fulfill that promise. We take that Binge Mode baby out of the wet nurse's arms.
Is that Wyla?
Is that Zach Mac? Guys. Spoiler warning as always, though, at this point, it's a little bit more of a speculation warning. We will be going deep on details from the show and the books from this episode and the beyond, which would include season 7 trailers and our hearts and minds. So, unsheath your swords and crown your kings, because it's time to break down season 6, episode 10. My personal favorite episode,
same,
not only of Game of Thrones, but of TV ever,
I think. It's incredible!
The Winds of Winter. Jason?
Yeah?
You're in the great game now.
Finally.
And the great game's terrifying.
True.
To keep those terrors at bay, let's offer up a brief refresher on what transpired in this incomparable season finale, which is jam-packed with intrigue and goodness and majestic wonders and is basically perfect.
Let's do this shit.
Let's take a quick trip down a very young King's Road.
Yeah. King's Landing.
Ooh.
Trial day.
Oh, yeah.
Loras Tyrell confesses to all charges and gets a seven-pointed star carved into his head. Next up, Cersei where is she? Watching and waiting, dressed all in black for the funeral of her enemies, actually. The Mad Queen's plot blossoms into a ferocious bouquet of emerald fire. The Mad King's cache of wildfire under the Sept of Baelor ignites, taking out large sections of Visenya's Hill, reducing the Sept of Baelor to rubble, and killing numerous notable lords and ladies, including Bells, Queen Marjorie, and Mason Loras.
Bells!
The High
Useless
Sparrow.
Bells. No, anti-bells. Anti-bells for the High Sparrow.
And then Kevin, with an A, and his son Lancel, who is on the cusp of bells. I'm not sure about Lancel with the bells. Qyburn's little birds.
Qyburn.
Perforate Grandmeister Pycelle. Give me those bells.
Give us many bells for Pycelle.
So many kings.
Secretly the MVP of this podcast.
King Tommen, gazing at the scene from the Red Keep, sees his mother's signature writ large across the ruins. He steps out of the window to his death. Give me the bells for King Tommen.
Agonizing.
And the cherry on top of her cake of revenge, Cersei sets the mountain on Septa Unella.
Shame.
Later, Saoirse reacts to Tommen's death with icy detachment.
Ugh, brutal.
She is proclaimed Queen of Westeros as Jaime looks on in shock.
Arguably the most flawless 20-some minutes in terms of
just pacing,
sequencing,
yeah,
the cuts,
the music.
It's
everything.
Majestic. It was absolutely stunning to watch that for the first time. At the Twins, Walder Filch holding a feast.
Yeah.
To celebrate the fall of Riverrun. Jaime and Bronn, guests of honor, serving girl, making eyes at Jaime.
As they always do.
Who could she be? Yeah. Well, glad you asked. They're not her eyes, turns out. Not her face. It's Arya. Wearing someone's skin like a savage. Or like a faceless man. She feeds Walder a pie made of minced Frey. Guys, Frey pie, we finally got it.
Yeah.
This is big. She unmasks so that he knows who his killer is. And in the very room where he presided over the Red Wedding, Walder Frey gets crossed off Arya's list.
Yeah. In Old Town, Sam and Gilly arrive at the Citadel. He attempts to check in at the front desk, but his email with the confirmation code hasn't arrived yet at Winterfell. Davos confronts Melisandre about Shireen as Jon looks on. The Red Woman admits to burning Shireen. Jon exiles her on pain of death.
Agonizing scene.
Incredible. Incredible work. Sansa on the battlements of Winterfell as they watch Melisandre stalk away. She apologizes to Jon for not telling him about the Knights of the Vale. Littlefinger finds Sansa in the Godswood, tries to kiss her. She rebuffs him, but just weakly enough to keep him in her game. Or is he keeping her in his? It's hard to tell at this point. And he begins the work of sowing discord between Jon and Sansa.
Concerned. Concerned about
extremely
that.
Extremely concerning.
In Dorne, Lady Olenna, in mourning colors after her house has been annihilated, her son, her grandson, her granddaughter killed by Cersei. She's there to meet with Ilaria and the Sand Snakes. Who should walk out but Varys on that speedboat? A grand alliance is struck. These folks are heading to Dany's side. In Meereen, where Dany waits, she has some business to take care of before she can head west. She needs to cut Dario loose from her bed and from her side. Stay behind in Meereen. Keep the peace in the city. He is not thrilled.
No.
Who can follow you?
Not a governing kind of guy.
Yeah, no, what's she thinking? Yeah. Weird choice. There are other ways to break up with guys. You don't just have to give them control of your city. It's like, just stop returning his text messages. Come on. Tyrion and Dany share a beautiful conversation before sailing west. And at the end of this exchange, she names him Hand of the Queen. He is uncharacteristically emotional. I am characteristically sobbing yes. into my keyboard. At last, with her new allies by her side, the Dothraki on the poisoned water, dragons in the air.
They look good.
Oh, they look great. Dany's Grand Armada. After literally 60 hours of us waiting for this.
Yes.
Finally sets sail for Westeros.
Up beyond the wall, Benjen Stark drops Bran and Meera at the Heart's Tree nearest Castle Black's gate. Bran reaches out to touch the Heart's Tree. Meera asks him if he's ready. He says he has to be. He touches the tree and he goes back to the Tower of Joy.
Oh boy.
Last days of Robert's Rebellion.
Oh God.
Bran follows his father Ned inside this time.
Oh my God.
And there he sees Lyanna Stark lying on the bed of blood, near
oh,
death.
Oh no.
She knows she's dying.
Jason, is this it?
Ned lays Dawn against the bed.
Oh my God.
Goes to her side. She makes him promise something.
Oh boy.
And then a nurse brings out the infant babe, Jon Snow. Smash cut to Winterfell, present day. Jon Snow. Sansa at his side presides over a summit of the victorious. There's some disagreement about what to do next. Jon tries to rally them to meet the challenge of the White Walkers, but many would prefer to just go home. Lyanna Mormont. God, Lyanna Mormont. Dunking again.
Queen. Queen.
Stirs the room to proclaim Jon Snow, the White Wolf, King in the North. And
King
as the cries
North.
Of King,
King
in the North.
King in the North.
Thunder through the hall.
King in the North.
Sansa's eyes meet Littlefinger's.
Extremely concerning.
Extremely concerning.
Wow, what a fucking episode.
It is so good.
It is truly close to flawless. Every single character has a meaningful moment. Some of those moments are so meaningful that we have been waiting decades.
Long ass time.
Decades to appreciate them. One of those moments in particular is so massive.
Just huge.
That we're going to shake things up a little bit today and head to the Citadel first, because we have got to talk about Jon's parentage reveal.
Yeah.
Jon's parentage, the question of who Jon's mother, and, you know, for the people who really cared about that, they also wanted to know about his father, but who is Jon's mother? What does that mean? This fueled a fan base for 20 years.
Yes.
This question.
That's absolutely.
So, gotta ask, Jason?
Yes.
Is that you?
It's me.
Is that really you?
I'm here.
You're not a dream?
I'm not a dream.
I ask because getting this reveal that we have been waiting 20 years for, people who have read the books since they first come out have been waiting 20 years to learn the answer to the question Jon asked Ned way back in season one. Who is his mother? And that smash cut from baby Jon to adult Jon felt like a dream. A dream that was both blissfully satisfying and agonizingly sad. So much happened in this episode, and we are going to dive into the themes and everything else soon, but we've got to start with this revelation that absolutely wowed a fan base. When people spend this much time anticipating something and theorizing about it and speculating and wondering and talking, it's really, really hard. Really hard for the reveal to live up to expectations. And this not only lived up, it exceeded. It is a beautiful moment of television and an incomparable execution of an idea. So now that we know, now that we finally truly know the answer to that question, please assemble a conclave and head to the Citadel. Teach us everything we need to know about the Tower of Joy reveal, the events preceding and following Ned's moment with Lyanna, and the monumental implications of learning that Jon is Lyanna Stark's son.
Okay, this is very exciting.
So exciting.
I'm going to set the scene here. Let's go back to 20 years, roughly, before the events of the first season of Game of Thrones. The Defiance of Duskendale takes place, which is an event during which Aerys was kidnapped for a time and Barristan ends up saving him. After that, Aerys' madness escalated to levels that could not be denied. 2 years after that, Rhaegar Targaryen, the Crown Prince, marries Elia Martell. Aerys significantly does not attend. The split between father and son has become extremely prominent. Rhaegar and Elia move to Dragonstone. A year after that, by 280, around there, the Mad King's insanity is at this point undeniable and dangerous for the realm. His moods shift violently, and he has taken to burning criminals with wildfire instead of the traditional headsman's axe and executions. Now, 281 AC, Lord Went of Harrenhal announces that he's going to have a tournament. This happens after his brother, Oswell Went, who is a Kingsguard. Now, Oswell Went in the show is the Kingsguard brother known as Gerald Hightower. They've kind of stuck them together and it's an amalgam. So Oswell Went goes to visit his brother, Lord Walter Went. And then soon after that, Walter announces that he's going to have this grand tournament. The purses announced for this tournament were far, far, far richer than anything that Lord Went could afford. So it was widely thought at the time that some mystery person was backing the Lord Went. Tournaments, and this is important context, provide the safest pretext for nobles from all across the realm to meet. And Rhaegar's name was thrown around as possibly being the backer. The Mad King decides to attend the tournament, but only because Varys, who he recently brought over from Essos, warns him that his son, Rhaegar, plans to use the tournament as an informal great council, possibly to decide whether to remove Aerys, who is dangerously insane, I say again, from power. At the tournament, Many lords and ladies got to see King Ares for the first time in person, and they were shocked by his appearance. He had long, scraggly hair. He had many cuts on his body from the Iron Throne. He had long fingernails, and his appearance was shocking. Also happening at this tournament, on the opening day, Jaime Lannister is named to the Kingsguard. Ares immediately orders him to King's Landing to guard Queen Rhaella and Viserys. Jaime never gets to see the rest of the tournament. Now, also in attendance, the Stark family.
Yes.
Little background here. Lord Rickard Stark, who is the father of Ned, Benjen, etc., was whispered to have had political ambitions that extended beyond the North, and these were characterized as Sothron ambitions. Lady Dustin in the fifth book says, Stark had great ambitions that would not be served by having his heir marry the daughter of one of his vassals, et cetera, et cetera. So,
Rickard, if you have to fight,
that's right.
Win.
That's
Remember,
right.
Remember, he's the guy we see in Bran's vision that's saying right. that to young Ned. If you have to fight,
exactly.
Win.
So is Lord Rickard somehow involved in the possible plotting that Rhaegar was doing in order to possibly overthrow his father? We don't know.
Oh,
so,
delicious. I love this shit.
Day one of the tournament, three teenage squires set upon a short of stature Crannog man, which are the people that live in the neck.
So Frog-eaters.
Yeah. Mira and Jojen are Crannog men. And many speculate that the Crannog man is Howland Reed. I think that's probybably fair to say.
Yes, 100%.
Lyanna Stark, then Robert Baratheon's betrothed, as we all know, saw this happening, and because the Crannog men are pledged to House Stark, she comes to his defense, beats these squires up with a tourney sword, takes Howland back to her tent, they clean and bind his wounds, and there Howland meets Brandon Stark, Ned Stark, and the youngest Benjen Stark. Lyanna later invites Howland to the great feast, where the nobles and their families are feasting for the opening of the tournament. Many great lords and ladies are there. Ashara Dane, who is the lady-in-waiting to Princess Elia Martell and widely considered one of the most beautiful women in the realm, is there, seen dancing with Ser Barristan,
loved
who
her.
Is madly in love with her, Oberyn Martell, John Connington, my Connington stands out there, and later, at Brandon's request, Ned Stark, because he was too nervous to talk to her, and many people say that Ned was in love with her. The Crannog man at this feast sees the squires who beat him up and is able to identify which knights they are in service to. Day two, very interesting developments at the tournament.
Oh my God.
A mystery knight.
This is one of my absolute favorite things.
Identity unknown,
mm-hmm.
but we can say small of stature, wearing mismatched armor, mm-hmm. carrying a shield with a smiling weirwood sigil. This mystery knight enters the list. He or she...
She.
I think we all agree that it's a she. But I'm just going to leave it open. He or she challenges the three knights whose squires beat up the Crannogman to fight within the context of the term. Mystery knight beats all three. He or she.
She.
Tells the knights that their squires must apologize in order for them to get their armor back. The mystery knight garnered so much attention that it started to get out of control. Many lords, including Robert Baratheon, wanted to unmask this mystery knight. Ares, paranoid, as always, wanted him unmasked too because he thought he was possibly some part of some plot to kill him or something. But the next day, Mystery Knight was gone. Only his or
her
shield was found up in a tree. Later, Rhaegar wins the joust, beating four members of the Kingsguard. He shocks the realm by riding past his wife, Elia, and placing a bouquet of blue winter roses in Lyanna Stark's lap, thus naming her the tournament's queen of love and beauty.
The moment when all the smiles died.
The smiles died. Now, sometime after the tournament, the time frame here is hard to say, but it's probably months, maybe. Lyanna Stark is kidnapped near Harrenhal by Rhaegar Targaryen with an assist from Arthur Dayne and Oswell Wendt. Remember, Oswell Wendt, again, is Hightower in the show, and these are Kingsguard. Robert's rebellion begins.
You better be putting that kidnapped in motherfucking air quotes,
kidnapped.
Mister.
Quote, kidnapped. We, you know, like, quote, kidnapped. So, 282 AC, Robert's rebellion. Brandon Stark and a few supporters go to the Red Keep. He demands that Rhaegar, quote, come out and die. Rhaegar is not there. Lyanna is not there. Aerys the Mad King is there. He has them arrested. Lord Rickard is ordered to come down, as are the fathers of the other people who are arrested. And eventually, Lord Rickard requests trial by combat, and the trial is essentially Lord Rickard versus fire. He is roasted alive in his own armor as Brandon, with a rope around his neck, reaches for a sword with which to cut his father's rope, and he chokes himself. He dies.
Horrifying.
Various battles take place, and over the course of the year, and then Rhaegar is killed at the Battle of the Trident.
Gods.
Hit him with a hammer! After this, the Lannister army sacks King's Landing. Jaime kills the Mad King. Elia Martell and Rhaegar's children are murdered by the Mountain. Ned Stark arrives shortly after this to find Jaime sitting on the throne, the Mad King at his feet. Robert arrives. This is all while Ned is there and is presented the bodies of Rhaegar's children by Tywin. This disgusts Ned. They get into an argument. He leaves the capital in order to fight the battles that are still going on further south and, of course, search for Lyanna, who is nowhere to be found in the capital. After this, Ned Stark goes to Storm's End, where he helps lift the siege, where Stannis is. Ned continues south to Dorne, the Tower of Joy. Now,
oh boy.
Ned and his companions, including Howland Reed, fight Arthur Dayne and the White Bull. Howland saves Ned's life. We saw this. Ned kills Dayne with the legendary sword Dawn, which he takes into the Tower of Joy and props against the Bed of Blood. We will go into why this might be important in a bit. Lyanna is inside near death, having just given birth. She makes him promise something regarding the safety of her child. The nurses kind of disappear. We don't know what happens to that later. Ned is known to have torn down the tower using the stones to build cairns for the fallen. He then heads to Starfall, seat of House Dayne, to return Dawn because he's a cool guy. At Starfall, Ned returns Dawn. Ashara Dayne, who we mentioned, Elia's lady-in-waiting, sister to Arthur Dayne, for reasons unknown, commits suicide. Or does she? Her body is never found. The rumored reasons involve either a dead child or a lost child or grief because of Sir Arthur. 283, Ned Stark returns home with a bastard child. Now, let's get into some of the other shit. In season one, episode two, Ned tells Robert that the mother of his bastard was named Wyla. Wyla, in the books, is known to be a wet nurse, i.e. a nurse who takes care of infants. And she provided breast milk to young Edric Dayne, the current Lord of Starfall. Now, in the books, Edric mentions to Arya that he and Jon Snow were, quote, milk brothers, meaning that Wyla also nursed Jon Snow. In other words, they nursed from the same womb. Okay. Years apart. Conclusion. R plus L equals J. Rhaegar plus Lyanna equals Jon.
Yeah.
Speculation. Ned returns to Starfall to bring back Dawn. We see the camera lingers on the way he places it against the bed, and we see that he has it. They do that for a reason. The camera also lingers on the nurse.
Yes.
This is my speculation for season seven. Ned returns to Starfall to bring back Dawn. He brings the nurse with him, who he passes off as the bastard's mother. That woman later nurses Edric Storm. This will be important later. I think we're going to Starfall next season.
I think so, too. The perfection with which this scene is executed, that's what's so amazing about this. A lot of what you just went over is stuff we knew already.
Right. But and to put it all together,
exactly,
it's like,
to
wow.
Finally, it's the last puzzle piece where everything suddenly clicks. Oof. Lyanna is the mystery knight.
Right.
Like,
she
come
has
on.
To be.
Yeah. Lyanna is the mystery knight, guys.
She beats the three squires easily right before that.
Also, all of these connections, especially in the book, between Lyanna and Arya.
Right.
That sort of helps, I think, cement the idea that Lyanna would be up to that physically and in Bran's season six vision when she comes in and the boys are jousting and she's got that same, like, well, I'm better than you bravado that Arya has when she shoots into Bran's target in
season
one.
She comes galloping in on the horse. Obviously, she can handle a horse. She could probably joust in the books. Bran has a vision of a person that we assume to be Lyanna beating one of her brothers at swordplay. Bran is like, is that Arya? No, Arya's never beaten me at swords. Who is that? And that's his. There's just too many allusions to Lyanna being good with weapons, good fighter, for it to be nothing.
So, the show tells us definitively that Lyanna, as long speculated, is in fact Jon's mother. Jon is not Ned's son. Ned never fathered a bastard. And yet, he lived the rest of his life from that point forward, letting people think he did, including his wife and his other children.
Yep.
A mark on his honor. Why? Well,
promises.
That's right. Hey guys, just a quick break to tell you about our sponsor. Binge Mode is brought to you by DirecTV Now. Live stream your favorite channels on virtually any device. Plus, you can subscribe to HBO and start watching Game of Thrones today. And now, back to Binge Mode.
Mal?
Yeah.
The war is not over.
No.
I promise you, friend.
Okay.
The true enemy won't wait out the storm. He brings the storm.
Thank you, Walter White.
And that gets us to this episode's big idea, so let's cut right to the core of it by sticking it with the pointy end. The defining theme of this episode, and maybe the story?
Yes.
Is promises kept.
We obviously have to continue with Lyanna and Ned for another moment here. Promise me, Ned.
Oof.
Those words are at the heart of our tale. They are an essential part of the central mystery of this story. Who were John's parents? What happened inside the Tower of Joy in the dying days of Robert's rebellion? Lyanna, please listen to me, Ned. If Robert finds out, he'll kill him. You know he will. You have to protect him. Promise me, Ned. Promise me. Early on in A Game of Thrones, the first book in A Song of Ice and Fire, Ned is reflecting back on Lyanna and the words promise me appear. For two decades, a fan base has grasped those two words like a fucking life raft. And here it is, confirmed at last. The promise was to take her baby and to never reveal who he is, because revealing his identity would ensure his death. Why? Because if John is the son of Lyanna Stark and Rhaegar Targaryen, he has a better claim to the throne than anyone if they were married. That's a big question.
Sure.
There's a lot of speculation about whether that could have happened. Obviously, the fact that he crowns Lyanna with the blue roses indicates a genuine affection there. There's a lot of debate. Part of the mystery here is around the idea of the kidnapping and the rape.
What's that relationship about?
Is that apocryphal?
Right.
Is that true? Were these two in love?
Yeah.
Because if they were, and I have never been able to accept the idea that John, the hero of this story, the one we are supposed to be rooting for, is the product of kidnapping and rape instead of love. If Lyanna and Rhaegar were in love, and John is actually the product not only of something pure and good, but of ice and fucking fire. Starks, ice.
Yeah.
Targaryens, fire. Direwolves, dragons. What this story is about. His is the Song of Ice and Fire. Remember what Dany sees, we've talked about this, what Dany sees Rhaegar say about the baby in his arms in the books in her House of the Undying vision. We thought for a while he was talking about his son Aegon. Maybe it was about Jon. Does John have a better claim than Dany if this is true? And what proof is there in the world? Because
that's important.
We see this. Finally, it's a mystery solved for us. Bran sees this. The way this is edited not only delivers max emotional impact with the surging score, the music and the smash cut, but with the way the camera is always positioned to ensure that we know Bran is hearing what we're hearing. Bran is seeing what we're seeing. What does Lyanna whisper to Ned that we can't hear?
Right.
Because there is a part right before she says, if Robert finds out, he'll kill him, that we can't hear. It sounds like maybe she's saying his name is. Now, two leading theories out there in the world. One, that she's saying he's Rhaegar's son.
Right.
The other, and this has been gaining momentum in the past few weeks due to a weird slip or leak of some sort. It's kind of unclear how this happened. His name is Jaehaerys.
Right.
That is the name of former Targaryen kings. If that is Jon's birth name, it's not proof. It's not irrefutable proof, but it is a link to the fact that there was love there. Because Lyanna's not naming her kid after a Targaryen king if Rhaegar kidnapped her and raped her. That would be a sign that this was something real. Where are the blue roses? Where is Rhaegar's harp? Where are the physical bits of evidence that can help us tie this all together? And if it was love, if they were married, maybe even if they weren't married, obviously Jon has become a king now, even as a bastard. Does he have a better claim than Dany? Does he want this? What does this mean for our story moving forward?
And also, who might know? Howland Reed was there. He was there, wounded, but he was there. Yes. And the nurses were there.
Let's not forget that Howland's daughter is with Bran.
That's right.
He's going to presumably in the beginning of season 7 have a chat with her about what he saw, which will include the fact that her father was present. Now, Howland wasn't up in the room, but you don't think that he's going to see a baby in Ned's arms when he comes down and helps him tear the tower down? What about Benjen?
Benjen knows something. He was at the tournament, so he knows something. I'm not sure how much he would know, but he knows something.
The nurse is 2 in the room, 1 we linger on a little longer.
Just the way the camera makes sure to look at her and look at the way she's looking at them. It feels intentional. It feels very intentional.
Yes. And I have long speculated that Littlefinger knows something. Not sure what, not sure how much, but enough to stir the pot.
Certainly to cause problems.
To cause dissent.
Yep.
And it doesn't seem like an accident that he and Sansa had a 20-minute conversation about Rhaegar and Lyanna in front of Lyanna's crypt.
Does not seem like that at all. Another promise kept, the Stark words. The motto of House Stark is among the realm's most iconic and implacable. Winter is coming. It's a promise, guys. And in this episode, as we go to Winterfell, you get that great shot of the big white raven flying in. Maesters around the realm send their astronomical measurements to the Citadel, where they are analyzed. And when the readings denote a change of seasons, they release the white ravens to the realm. Winter is here. And Sansa and Jon on the battlements are talking about this. Jon, she says, a raven from the Citadel, a white raven, winter is here. These words at last. And Jon smiles. Well, father always promised, didn't he? It's been about 10 years since the last.
I love that moment.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Oh, what a fucking comeback for Ned.
It really is. And also, like, just what a feeling that must be to be in your ancestral home. The words of your family have come true. It's really a time. Winter is a time of despair and death for much of the realm. But for the Starks, no one is more prepared. No one has built their identity more around we own the winter.
And think of the uncertainty and the peril that has defined life for Jon and Sansa for the last few years. Here is a cycle.
Yeah.
Something you can count on. A guarantee. Maybe not a pleasant one, but there's weirdly comfort in routine.
So they're standing on the battlements and they're talking about their relationship and talking about trust.
And they're talking about how they're suddenly the same height.
It shouts to the crate that Kit Harington stands on. Jon says, I'm having the Lord's chambers prepared for you. It sounds like his mother and father's room. You should take it. I'm not a Stark. You are to me, she says. You're the Lady of Winterfell. You deserve it. We're standing here because of you. The battle was lost. Until the Knights of the Vale rode in, they came because of you. You told me Lord Baelish sold you to the Boltons. He did. And you trust him. Only a fool would trust Littlefinger. I should have told you about him, about the Knights of the Vale. I'm sorry. And then Jon pleads with her almost. We need to trust each other. We can't fight a war amongst ourselves. We have so many enemies now. Uh-oh. I am very worried about these two.
Extremely concerned about this.
I'm extremely concerned about a certain hand of the king in the north. Who I feel like would be the first target of any plot against Jon.
Stop it.
Okay.
Stop it.
So then later on in the Godswood, Sansa sitting by the tree as Starks are wont to do. And Littlefinger says, forgive me, lady, if you're at prayer. I'm done with all that. I came here every day when I was a girl, prayed to be somewhere else. Back then, I only thought about what I wanted, never what I had. I was a stupid girl. You were a child, Littlefinger says. What do you want? I thought you knew what I wanted. Yeah. Littlefinger, the fucking creep. I was wrong, Sansa says. No, you weren't. Every time I'm faced with a decision, I close my eyes and I see the same picture. Whenever I consider an action, I ask myself, will this action help to make this picture a reality? Pull it out of my mind and into the world. And I only act if the answer is yes. A picture of me on the Iron Throne, you by my side.
The way he says that is haunting.
It's very not good. And he moves to kiss her, but she stops him with a hand on the chest. It's a pretty picture, she says, and walks off. Littlefinger stops her. News of this battle will spread quickly through the Seven Kingdoms. I've declared for House Stark for all to hear. Hey.
So weird to hear him say that. I've declared for House Stark for all to
very,
hear.
Very, very strange, and also a dangerous thing to have Littlefinger supporting you so openly. He's supported the Lannisters very openly, the Boltons very openly. The past is gone for good. You can sit here mourning its departure or help me prepare for the future. You, my love, are the future of House Stark. Who should the North rally behind? A true-born daughter of Ned and Catelyn Stark or a motherless bastard born in the South? It begins. And the interesting thing about this scene is Sansa rebuffs him, but not savagely, not in a way that would cut the cord, in a way that it's like they're both keeping each other in play. Whose game is it? Is it Sansa's game or is it Littlefinger's game? We don't know yet.
Littlefinger taught her a lot. One thing was not to trust him, but
yeah.
The other thing was to always keep them guessing.
Right.
And whether that's something you want to be doing or not, it seems to be ingrained at this point. What about the North as a whole? The North's promised. The North remembers.
Yeah.
We know no king, but the king in the North, whose name is Stark. Well, people were kind of sleeping on that for a little while. And here we get it in resounding, resurgent fashion. It's been a long time, guys, since we had the thrill of watching Robb's men anoint him king in the North. To see this happen for Jon, a bastard who wasn't even, as he tells Melisandre, allowed to sit at the head table with his family at dinner, raised to king. It's incredible. It's incredible. I will get fucking chills. No, I don't even have to watch it. Just thinking about it. And who got this going?
The queen.
Who got this fucking going?
The queen in the North.
The queen. Lyanna Mormont. Standing up. Because people are bickering. People, that fucking asshole, Royce.
Yeah, we're going home. And then, like, Lord Kerwin, whose daddy is...
Flayed.
And he's like, yeah.
Because of taxes.
We're done with this, right? We're over it. And by the way, like, a little aside... Castle Kerwin is like half a day's ride from Winterfell, very, very close. So it's like a little bit disturbing to have Lord Kerwin be like, yeah, I think we should all just go home and I'm over it. You're half a day's ride away.
Guess he really wanted to get back.
Yeah.
Lyanna stands up, looks around at these men who just seem either unwilling to take action or resigned to their circumstances. Call to action. Your son was butchered at the Red Wedding, Lord Manderly. Fucking Manderly. Here he is. I thought of you immediately.
He's great in the books. Manderly is just a king in the book.
But you refused the call. You swore allegiance to House Stark, Lord Glover, but in their hour of greatest need, you refused the call. And you, Lord Kerwin, your father was skinned alive by Ramsay Bolton.
Oof.
Still, you refused the call. But House Mormont remembers... I'm getting a chill. The North remembers. We know no king but the king in the North, whose name is Stark. Oh my God, this is so good. Holy shit. Ooh. We should have baked in an extra 4 hours just for me to cry. I don't care if he's a bastard. Ned Stark's blood runs through his veins. Technically true.
Yeah, sure. Close enough.
He's my king. From this day until his last day. And boy, was that effective. Your homie Manderly stands up, and what does he have to say?
Manderly, shamed into standing up, and he says, Lady Mormont speaks harshly and truly. She gives him that little nod. My son died for Robb Stark, the young wolf. I didn't think we'd find another king in my lifetime. I didn't commit my men to your cause because I didn't want more Manderlys dying for nothing. And then he goes on to say that Jon avenged the Red Wedding and proclaims him king in the North. And then
the White Wolf. I love it.
Oh, the White Wolf. I hope he coined that. I hope he got some trademarks on that.
Yo, side note.
He is the White Wolf.
Where's Ghost?
And then Lord Robert Glover, who we all remember turned down Jon and Sansa's appeal.
In pathetic fashion.
In pathetic fashion. He says, and he looks absolutely dismayed at his own actions, at himself. I did not fight beside you on the field, and I will regret that until my dying day. And by the way, this is a thing that means a lot to these people, what they will say, what your ancestors will say about you 100, 200, 300, 1,000 years from now. They will say of Lord Glover, he did not go that day. They will say that about him, and he knows it. And he says, a man can only admit when he was wrong and ask forgiveness, Jon Snow says. There's nothing to forgive, my lord. And then Glover steals up. There will be more fights to come. House Glover will stand beside House Stark as we have for 1,000 years. And by the way, it's been longer than 1,000, but that's just, they always round to 1,000. And I will stand behind Jon Snow, the king in the North.
Chills.
It's double, like
the rally cry starts. Everyone.
King of the North.
Everyone. And
the
then
king of the North.
Davos.
Oh, I love this.
Just moment. A half second later than everyone else, standing up because he's stunned.
That's like just incredible acting from Liam Cunningham. Like the way he
phenomenal fucking episode.
There's like
from
a
him.
Hitch in the way he stands, as if he's just been shocked by the way by what's unfolding, and all of a sudden he's going to be serving a king that he actually respects.
Right. Think about his
out of nowhere
arc. He was always devoted.
Yes, devoted.
Bound to Stannis, but he had anytime he was in a crowd, a chant, it was something that repelled him, that horrified him. This is the first time that he's been able to look around and say, oh, something really special and good is happening here.
Well, Davos is always, with Stannis, Davos was always having to go around and apologize for Stannis.
Right.
Yes, Stannis burns people, but he's actually good.
with John,
that's not going to be an issue. And then as, you know, as that chant is just echoing around the room, Sansa smiling, her smile wilting ever so slightly, and then Littlefinger, like a fucking creep in the corner, their eyes meet and it's chilling. And then John's promise, the Great War. He says, the war is not over. I promise you, friend, the true enemy won't wait out the storm. He brings the storm. That's what John, that was John's pitch before everyone was started proclaiming him King of the North. This is John's promise.
The look that Littlefinger gives as the crowd is growing raucous. They're yelling, they're chanting, raising their swords. John is standing. He turns to Sansa with like, can you believe this is happening? He lets out like a little smile, and then he starts. It's really.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, this is happening. Breathing deeply and heavily. Looks serious. The way that Littlefinger is just leaning against the wall, casually conveying with the subtlest of expressions and glances.
What did I tell you, Sansa? Right? That's what he's saying.
That's yours.
Right.
What's happening here?
Right.
That's yours. Yep. One of the most chilling moments in the show. We have spent a lot of time, rightly so, talking about literally the most important thing that's ever happened on this show. I feel good about that decision. But the episode did not open with John.
No.
The episode opened with Cersei, who is also crowned another new ruler, guys. A new king in the North and a new ruler in King's Landing. Cersei crowned. Cersei on the Iron Throne. How did we get here? We got here thanks to one of the most astonishing sequences and one of the most
that's incredible
vicious choices that a character has ever made.
And Cersei's been making promises, violent promises, all these years to Joffrey, season one. Everyone who isn't us is an enemy. And that is on display as Cersei sits there in the throne room, the Sept of Baelor smoking miles away. Last season, season 5, episode 8, Hardhome, Cersei says to Anella, my face will be the last thing you see.
Boy.
We know that's true. And then the opener of season 6 to Jaime, after she tells him about the prophecy, she says, I knew this would happen. The witch told me years ago. She promised me 3 children, promised me they'd die and gold their shrouds. Everything she said came true. You couldn't have stopped it. It's prophecy. It's fate. Jaime says, you don't believe that. She says, of course I do. You told me yourself. When father died, you said we had to stay together. You said people would try to tear us apart, take what's ours. That was a prophecy. And then Jaime makes her a promise. Fuck prophecy, fuck fate, fuck everyone who isn't us. We're the only ones who matter, the only ones in this world, and everything they've taken from us, we're going to take back and more. Cersei's living that right now.
That's before. That, they're only 2 out of 3 at that point with the gold shrouds, and she's pretty much given up.
And then all these other promises to Lancel when he comes to bring her to a meeting with the High Sparrow. And he gives her the choice. Order your man to step aside or there'll be violence. She says, I choose violence. Yes, she has.
Yes.
To Tommen, when Tommen says to her, I should have executed all of them. I should have pulled down the sept onto the High Sparrow's head before I let them do that to you, as you would have for me. You raised me to be strong, and I wasn't. But I want you to help me. Help me. And Cersei says, always. And then to Margaery, season 3, episode 8. They're sitting, you know, they're hanging out. Cersei says, Reigns of Castamere, have you heard about it? And Margaery says, of course. They play it so often here, Cersei says. But you know the story. You know what the lyrics are about. Not as well as you, I'm sure. And Cersei lays it out. House Rain was a powerful family. Very wealthy. Second wealthiest in Westeros. Sound familiar? Aren't the Tyrells the second wealthiest family in Westeros now? She says, of course. Ambitious climbers don't want to stop on the second highest rung. If only you could take that final step, you'd see further than all the rest. You'd be alone with nothing but blue sky above you. So Lord Rain built a castle as grand as Casterly Rock. He gave his wife diamonds larger than any mother ever wore. And finally, one day, he rebelled against my father. Do you know where House Rain's is now?
Saying that to her in the Sept, in the place that she will kill her.
Unbelievable. And then with Unella, in a truly chilling and disturbing, and Cersei's killed a lot of people, but this is among the most evil things that she's ever done. She has Sept Unella tied to a table, calls in the mountain. First, she tells her, it felt good, didn't it? Beating me, starving me, frightening me, humiliating me. You didn't do it because you cared about my atonement. You did it because it felt good. I understand. I do things because they feel good. And now the irony of Cersei finally confessing everything to Unella as she's tied to this table. I killed my husband because it felt good to be rid of him. That's not necessarily true. She just made sure that he stayed drunk. I fucked my brother because it feels good to feel him inside of me. I lie about fucking my brother because it feels good to keep our son safe from hateful hypocrites. I killed your high sparrow and all his little sparrows, all your septons and all his septas, all his filthy soldiers because it felt good to watch them burn. And then she brings in the mountain. Woof. And by the way, Tommen's death proves
agonizing
the
moment.
Prophecy.
An agonizing moment.
Just a chilling moment. The way she has almost no response to this. This was her world. Tommen was everything to her. And the detachment there is terrifying. Almost it's, more terrifying than her rage would have been.
Totally. It's the resignation of knowing that no matter what she does to stop this thing looming over her from happening, it happens. Of course, the part that she's not seeing is that she's causing it to happen. Right. Tommen jumps out of a window. Tommen kills himself because of what she did. There's no other way.
And Cersei, all these people that we just mentioned, Cersei has promised them at different times throughout the seasons that they would face her wrath. And it's come true. Cersei has come good on her promise.
One of the complicating things there is what that means for her brother lover.
Oh, yeah.
Jaime. Jaime has made a promise very recently to Edmure about getting back to Cersei. That's exactly why I came here, he says about Riverrun. I love Cersei. You can laugh at that if you want. You can sneer. It doesn't matter. She needs me. And to get back to her, I have to take Riverrun. I'll send for your baby boy and I'll launch him into Riverrun with a catapult because you don't matter to me, Lord Edmure. Your son doesn't matter to me. The people in this castle don't matter to me. Only Cersei. And if I have to slaughter every Tully who ever lived to get back to her, that's what I'll do.
Well. Yeah. Well.
Someone's slaughtering everyone. Yeah. Jaime then is at the Twins with Lord Walder, celebratory meal, and he has to sit there and let Walder fucking Frey go all,
here now, two Kingslayers
on him.
Yeah.
And you just got to sit there and say, is this a life that Jaime Lannister was meant to live? Are these the promises that he was meant to keep?
And he wears that disappointment on his face. You could feel it on him.
Completely. He's having an exchange like that forces Jaime to look inward in a way that really like only Brienne has in a very positive way. And now he's sort of saying, wait a minute. This is what I'm doing.
Right.
This is who I'm with. And then he heads home back to Cersei just like he promised he would. And what does he see? He rides into the capital and sees the city burning. You have to remember that Jaime's entire identity is wrapped up in the idea of him being the Kingslayer,
a
Kingsguard who killed his king. Why did he kill his king? Because Aerys was going to do exactly what Cersei just did. Jaime made a promise to himself all those years ago to never let that happen, to never let one ruler's blind ambition and rage compromise the safety of the people of the realm.
That's such a great point.
Think about this moment for him. He rides up and he sees King's Landing aflame, sees the thing that he sacrificed his entire reputation and in many ways, as a result, his life to prevent. He sees that happen thanks to the one person he's doing these horrible things to return to. What an agonizing moment that must be for him. And then to go, because of course you have to assume for a second is there fear? Oh, I hope Cersei's okay. Is my family okay?
Or is there just
certainty right away? Does he know her well enough? Either way, that's awful. And when he goes in to the throne room and sees, and it is a chilling scene, sees her walking, making her way up to the Iron Throne that he sat on once.
Yes.
Right after trying to stop this from happening. Right after successfully stopping this from happening. The look that passes between them when he sees her crowned.
That's unbelievable.
Is incredible. And we think, it's a guess.
Yeah.
It is speculation, but we think that this atrocity that Cersei has committed, which led to the death of their son, of Jaime's son,
whose body she had burned and the ashes sprinkled on the sept,
befouling the family name and legacy that they have fought to protect. This will be what leads him to fulfill the Valancor portion of the prophecy. Wrap his hand around her throat. No accident that all of a sudden all of her
gowns
have a high neck. There's armor on her shoulders. Strangle the life out of her.
Olenna, Ilaria, and Varys will hit these quick. After Oberyn's death, Ilaria took up the cause of justice for Dorne. And she and the Snakes launched their coup expressly because Prince Doran was weak and ineffectual. Remember back in the season premiere of season 6, Ilaria says to Doran, "When was the last time you left this palace? You don't know your own people. They're disgust for you. Elia Martell raped and murdered. You did nothing. Oberyn Martell butchered and you did nothing. You're not a Dornishman. You're not our prince." And then when he asks about his son, Ilaria says, "Your son is weak, just like you, and weak men will never rule Dorne again." That's a promise, as is the promise that she will take action. Olenna is there at this meeting and says, "The last time a Tyrell came to Dorne, he was assassinated. 100 Red Scorpions, was it?" This is how much people hate Cersei. Longtime foes, longtime antagonists. The Reach and Dorne have had a bloody, bloody history. They're aligning because they hate her more. They need to take her down. And this fits the prophecy. Cersei is arming a queen, Dany, with allies who want to take Cersei down. And then there's a promise for the future. Olenna says, "Cersei stole the future from me." Look at how like heartbreaking that is. Her son, her grandchildren, the future of House Tyrell is gone, and she's old. How many years does she have to do something about this? Not many. Right. "She killed my son. She killed my grandson. She killed my granddaughter. Survival is not what I'm after now. It's not about the legacy, the future of the house. She wants revenge." And Ilaria says back, "You're absolutely right. I chose the wrong words. It's not survival I offer. It's your heart's desire." And what is our heart's desire? And Olenna says, "Vengeance, justice." And out comes Varys. Fire and blood. Speaking of Varys, he has been working towards this since season one. Remember that meeting with Illyrio Mopatis where they're talking in very vague terms about a timeline, about something
about the wolf and the lion and the savages.
And it's happening faster than they thought. It maybe ended up happening a little bit slower than they thought, but it's truly happening now. And then Dany and Tyrion making promises to each other. Tyrion really bearing his soul to Dany, as many people do. "For what it's worth," he says, "I've been a cynic for as long as I can remember. Everyone's always asking me to believe in things, family, gods, kings, myself. I was often tempted until I saw where belief got people. So I said no thank you to belief. Yet here I am. I believe in you." It's embarrassing, really. "I'd swear you my sword, but I don't actually own a sword." And she says, "It's your counsel that I need."
Oh, man.
"It's yours now and always." When has Tyrion Lannister ever spoken like this?
Incredible.
And she says, "Good. I had something made for you. I'm not sure if it's right." And she pins the hand of the queen badge on him and names him Tyrion Lannister. "I name you hand of the queen." And he
chills.
Looks more emotional than he has ever looked in the entire series.
Oh.
Kneels before her. And it's a fantastic moment from this show.
A testament to the strength, to the really unrivaled, unsurpassed strength of the episode is that that moment is the most important thing in like 55 other episodes of Game of Thrones, if it happens in them. And here it's like the C or D plot, which is just amazing. Well, What's next for Dany? What's next for Tyrion? Sailing west at long last. I think only complaint really about this episode is ending it on Dany.
Yes.
Definitely a big moment. Her finally heading west is huge. Certainly a promise fulfilled, as we'll get to momentarily. But is it bigger than Jon? Is it bigger than what Cersei did? I don't know. Maybe I'm just out on Dany after this rewatch. That might be it. Dany's been making this promise about heading west for quite some time. Yeah. We could quote 50 things here, but let's go back to season one when she got Drogo. This is so telling. Drogo, a call of a Khalasar, Dothraki, to say this, and to my son, the stallion who will mount the world, I will also pledge a gift. I will give him the iron chair that his mother's father sat upon. I will give the land of the Andals. I, Drogo, will do this. I will take my Khalasar west to where the world ends and ride wooden horses across the black salt sea, as no Khal has done before. I will kill men in iron suits and tear down their stone houses. Dany has made this promise to other people. She has made this promise to herself. Sail west. Think of how she shouted at the Spice King back in Carth. When I take back my throne, my dreams are different.
Right.
Think of the things she said over the years. I'm not going to stop the wheel. Right. I'm going to break the wheel. Every statement Dany makes is a promise. It's a declaration of intent. It's a pledge to take what's hers, what she thinks is hers. And for the first time in six seasons, it's about to happen. She's back on track here. And this is, you know, ultimately tangential, but kind of sad. She promised Tyrion, apparently, that she wouldn't take Daario with her. And amusingly, she uses the promise that Daario made her as an out. Yeah. You promised me. Because he's like, what? I'll just be your fuck buddy. Right. I don't care. I'm not proud. Let's go.
Yeah.
You promised me. My sword is yours. My life is yours. Well, this is what I command. If I'm going to rule in Westeros, I need to make alliances. And what does an alliance mean? Marriage. She can't have a lover with her.
Right.
She is certainly focused enough on fulfilling her promise to let go of some of the pleasant things in life. And Tyrion compliments her on this. You know, it's that kind of sacrifice that makes you a good ruler. And her reply is extremely telling. She's not sad.
No.
Because she said goodbye.
No.
She's like kind of sad because she didn't feel sad.
Right.
That is the strength of Dany's promise. Nothing else matters. It's all about getting what's hers.
There's Sam and Gilly at the Citadel. Their promise to
love
each other
guys.
And Sam's promise to himself, really, that maybe he's never even vocalized before this. Remember season 4, episode 9, the Watchers on the Wall episode after Gilly makes her way to Castle Black after the sack of Molestown, shouts to Molestown Whore.
Molestown Whore!
Sam says, I'm so sorry, I didn't know until I got back. And Gilly says, don't let them send me away, Sam. Sam, never. Gilly, I know there's no women allowed. Sam, anyone who tries to throw you out will be having words with me. From now on, wherever you go, I go too. And they have stuck to that, guys. They have stuck to it. And then season 5, episode 5, Sam's future. What has Sam always wanted to do? What does Sam love? He's really the avatar for George in this, you know? The guy who just loves books, is nerdy, and somehow, you know, lucked into the love affair of his life. Stannis sees Sam reading about the Long Night in the archives of Castle Black, and Sam is telling him about Dragonglass and how he killed a White Walker and all the things he's learned. And Stannis says, keep reading, Samwell Tarly. Maybe that's the promise Samwell made to himself long ago that he's never spoken out loud, and that's what he's going to do next season.
Go learn things that will help Jon, please. And then there's Davos and Shireen. Davos and Mel. The Lord of Light.
Yeah.
Back in season 5, pains us to think of the time where we lost young Shireen and her Reading Rainbow show. But when Davos gave her that stag, she asked why. Why is she getting a gift? Because you deserve it. My son was always on me trying to teach me to read. Gods. I was stubborn about it. Gods.
Gods.
Made it this far without reading. Seemed to me I could make it to the grave. I wish I had listened to them. This is my own poor way of saying thank you for teaching me to be a grown-up. Oh, man. Yeah. I'll be gone for a few days, princess. I want to hear all about the Dance of Dragons when I'm back. Agonizing, Shireen says. You'll just have to read it yourself. Ugh. And of course, that is true because she is not around to read it to him. And now he knows why. And in this episode, when he confronts Melisandre, one of the truly standout performances by the actors in this episode. Just incredible.
Flawless stuff.
If he commands you to burn little children, your lord is evil.
Yes.
He says to Melisandre. We are standing here because of him, she replies. Jon Snow is alive because the Lord willed it. I loved that girl like she was my own. She was good, she was kind, and you killed her. So did her father, Melisandre says. So did her mother. Her own blood knew it was the only way. They all died anyway, Davos says. And he's right.
Yeah.
You told everyone Stannis was the one. You had him believing it. All of them fooled. You lied. She says, I didn't lie. I was wrong. He says, you were wrong. How many died because you were wrong? What happens when you make a false promise?
Yeah.
What happens when people give their lives and make sacrifices that can never be undone because of a promise you made? Promise for the future issued right here. Davos wants Mel executed. And John, there's a part of him that knows that he is maybe not done with her yet. Well, you can feel it. He senses it.
She brought him back and it's, you know, so you get one strike.
Right. And she says it to him too.
Yeah.
I have a role to play.
Yes.
In the Great War. I'm not afraid to die. Right. I just don't think I'm done yet.
Right.
And he says, ride south today. If you return to the north, I'll have you hanged as a murderer. Davos follows up. If you ever come back this way, I'll execute you myself. Gotta think that this is going to come to a head in season 7.
So many long gestating promises coming to fruition. Arya and Walder Frey and the list. Arya's defining characteristic is that list, that promise to herself that she will take revenge on the people who massacred her family, murdered her friends. And Walder Frey is one of the more notable names on this list. He carried out the Red Wedding right under his very roof, spurning the ancient traditions of Guestright. And now Arya is ready to fulfill the promise she made to herself all the way back in, starting in season 2, before Frey was even on the list, when she began whispering the names at Harrenhal. She said, my name is Arya Stark. I want you to know that. She takes off her face and stares at him. The last thing you're ever going to see is a Stark smiling down at you as you die. And the story gave us a little promise of a little Easter egg, too. The Frey pies and the rat cook and the people
who, love it.
Book people will recall that Manderly cooked the sons of the Freys, some Frey boys, into a pie and fed them to a Lord of Frey.
Finally, Benjen. Before Bran taps into the tree trinet, Benjen says farewell. This is where I leave you. Bran says you're not coming with us. And Benjen explains.
Yeah.
He can't. The wall isn't just ice and stone. Ancient spells are carved into its foundation, strong magic, to protect men from what lies beyond. And while it stands, the dead cannot pass. I cannot pass. Guys, while it stands, the dead cannot pass. Well, then it cannot stand.
Exactly.
For Game of Thrones, the television experience to conclude. Yeah. This is the show promising us that the wall is coming down.
Mal.
Yes.
I said my face would be the last thing you saw before you died. Do you remember?
I do.
So let's share 7 of our favorite insights and observations from this episode, lightning round style.
You go first.
I'll go first, sure. Number one, this episode is called The Winds of Winter. George's as of yet unfinished 6th novel, arguably more anticipated and argued over than any book in modern history, is called The Winds of Winter. Homage? Trolling? It felt slightly trolling, to be fair, when it happened.
Yeah, really tough.
It felt slightly trolling or full-on dickish, especially in the light of the massive reveals contained within this episode. I lean slightly insensitive troll.
Really tough.
It's tough. I mean, it had to hurt.
To not be in control of revealing Lyanna. Like, name the episode something else after that. That's just fucking
brutal.
Brutal. Number two, we just want to take a moment to appreciate the craftsmanship in this episode, particularly the music
of Ramin Djawadi. His
beautiful
score is impeccable.
The Light of the Seven.
Yes.
Incredible stuff.
Number three. Marjorie. So was Marjorie actually a great player in the game, as we've said so many times? Or did she just get outclassed? I'll give you here's my theory. I think she would have been a great queen, but the rules changed. It's kind of like when the three-pointer and analytics changed basketball over the course of 5 years. All of a sudden, you don't have centers anymore. I think that's what happened to Marjorie. In normal, more stable times, she would have been among the greatest queens this realm has ever seen. The difference was Cersei, while not as smart, politically savvy, et cetera, was just willing to be much more ruthless and get to that ruthless place much faster than anyone else. And she changed the game because of her willingness to be extremely violent, extremely fast.
Number four.
Yeah.
Guys, the Citadel needs to upgrade its Wi-Fi routers. Sam arrives. Very excited. And he's like, I'm here. You know, I'm here to become the new maester at Castle Black. Let's get going. I'm jazzed. I'm ready. Read through my orientation pamphlets and everything.
Right.
And the dude who greets him is like, Jon Snow, what? Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about. According to our records, Gior Mormont is Lord Commander.
Come on, guys.
A little off here. And Sam says he died. We received no report from the maester at Castle Black. Well, he died too.
Yeah.
This is irregular. Great comeback from Sam here. Yes, well, I suppose the life is irregular. Also, I just want to shout out the look on Sam's face when he walks into the library in the Citadel. It is incredible. It's like walking into the Burrow and Dumbledore's office, all kind of wrapped up into one. Makes me think of those instruments in Dumbledore's office. It always does. Beautiful. There's a little bit of a British Museum reading room like aspect to it too. Ah, it's amazing.
All the wood. Number five. All that wildfire foreshadowing Bran's vision.
Ah, clarity at last.
I love that part of it. That was one of the secretly most portentous quick scenes in the whole series. Great.
Number six. We've talked about Benjen multiple times over the course of this episode, and he was in this episode for about 4 seconds, so that's interesting. And it's also interesting to think about what role he might play moving forward. He says to Bran, the Great War is coming, and I still fight for the living. I'll do what I can for as long as I can. What might that be? Because he clearly has a role to play. Could he come to Jon's aid when Jon is north of the Wall?
I think that's a great guess, and I think that will happen. Number seven.
Finally.
Varys on his freaking speedboats. Listen, he sailed from Slaver's Bay to Dorne, assembled a fleet from two regions. The Reach and Dorne assembled a fleet. Then he sailed back to Meereen with the fleet. This is like, that's probably 10 months.
And he got all those other people to do that too. There are obviously we see Theon, we see the Greyjoy ships, but there are clearly Martell and Tyrell ships in Dany's fleet when she's sailing.
I mean,
a lot of people to mobilize there.
That's amazing.
Jason?
Yeah.
We need to trust each other.
It's so true.
We can't fight a war amongst ourselves.
We must not do that.
We have so many enemies
and
now.
They're everywhere.
And each episode, we are going to honor. We have been honoring the person or persons, people who played the game, advanced his or her or their cause in some tangible way, or just frankly did something awesome. And this week, we are thrilled to say that the winners of our champion's purse are Lyanna and Ned Stark. You guys thought we hated Ned, but here we are, giving little Eddard the champion's purse.
Here's the thing. I think watching the Tower of Joy, it's like that. It's like when your friends start becoming parents and you start realizing, like, that parents aren't godlike figures. They're just people that are doing their best. Ned and Lyanna they did their best. And think about Lyanna lying there in the bed of blood, carrying this child all this time. It's a part of her. The war is raging all around her. She may not even know if Rhaegar's dead. She knows this. She's not going to live to see her son grow up. And the entire world wants to kill him. Robert, her betrothed, wants to kill him. Tywin Lannister would like nothing more than to deliver the body of this child to Robert Baratheon. Everyone wants to kill this child. All she can do is make her brother swear a promise to protect him. And he did.
It worked.
They did. It worked. Jon Stark is a king. Shouts to Ned and Lyanna. They made a lot of mistakes, but they did their best and they had the best of intentions. And ultimately, it kind of worked out.
That's so all far. That's all any of us can ever do.
Yes, the promise
our best
was kept.
Beautiful. Truly beautiful. Now I'm going to cry again at the end. Thanks, asshole. Guys, bingers, every time we're faced with a decision, we close our eyes and see the same picture.
Yes.
Whenever we consider an action, we ask ourselves, will this action help to make this picture a reality? Pull it out of our minds and into the world. And we only act if the answer is yes. A picture of us in this podcast studio with you listening.
Yes.
And that's why we are pleased to tell you we will be back for season 7. We are going to keep binge mode going. We will be deep diving each week after every new Game of Thrones episode airs. So please, please keep tuning in. Please keep the tweets coming. Keep the conversation going. We hope that you had as much fun as we did binging these first 60 with us. And we really hope you're going to be there with us for season 7. We want to say sincerely thank you for traveling this King's Road with us, for sailing the narrow sea with us, and supporting the show. This has been really, really awesome and really fun. And we are just really glad that you guys liked it. And, you know, we're sad that this phase of the journey is over. But as Qyburn says,
Qyburn! Qyburn, you're great.
Sometimes before we can usher in the new, the old must be put to rest.
Special thanks to, of course, George R. R. Martin, whose words created this magnificent world that we live in.
Thank you as well to Colin Orcutt and Joe Fuentes, liege lords of the audio realm.
Isaac Lee and Sean Yu, who helped us on so many technical matters. Kyle Crichton and Ruby Edmondson.
Zach Kramlin Cram. Riley Mac McAtee.
David Shoemaker. Of course, Bill Simmons. Eric Weinberger and Jeff Chow.
Never forget that Bill Simmons came into my office a few months ago and said, got an idea for you guys.
Boom.
This will be fun. And you know what? He was right.
He was right.
This was fun.
It
thanks,
was extremely
Bill.
Fun.
Thanks, Bill. Great idea. And guys, finally, thanks to Zach Mad Axe Mac, the best producer in all the realm. Here with us day and night, weekday and weekend. In it to win it and to talk about naked women on Game of Thrones. Shouts to you, Mad Axe. You invented bells. And finally, thanks to you, Jason, my maester. This was really fun, bud.
Thanks, Mel.
Love you.
Couldn't have done it without you.
Likewise. Woo!
You did it.
We did it!